From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, golf's bad boy, John Daly. He doesn't have an exercise regimen. He begins his day with a Diet Coke and a cigarette and has battled addictions to alcohol and gambling. But he sure can play. He has a memoir and a new golf guide called Golf My Own Damn Way. Also, cartoonist Matthew Diffie tells us about some of the cartoons that didn't make it into the New Yorker magazine. He's edited a new collection of misfires, some too racy, some too lowbrow, some hard to understand. And rock historian Ed Ward considers the career of songwriter, producer, and performer Jerry Williams Jr., otherwise known as Swamp Dog. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. The fact that John Daly is a pro golfer who's won two of the tour's four major tournaments may be among the least interesting things about him. As Daly says in his memoir, he's won tournaments on five continents, downed enough booze to get into emergency rooms and rehab clinics, beat up hotel rooms, houses, and cars, gambled away a couple of fortunes, married four times, and now lives on Diet Coke and Marlboro Lights. I guess you could say, Daly writes, I'm not exactly a poster boy for moderation. Daly's behavior has earned him fines and suspensions from the PGA, but he is adored by fans, in part because he's a plain-spoken Arkansas boy who doesn't try to cover up his flaws, but also because people love to watch him hit a ball. He's a huge bear of a man, blessed with the flexibility of a fencer, and when he turns his shoulder into a swing and releases his power into a golf ball, it travels eye-popping distances. I spoke to John Daly about his memoir, called My Life In and Out of the Rough, and his new instructional book, Golf My Own Damn Way. You know, a batter has a half a second to decide whether to swing at a ball, and a shortstop has to react quickly. A football moves quickly, so does basketball, but in a golf tournament, you play 4 days, and if you're ahead on that last day, you have lots and lots of time to think about how you're going to screw up a shot. I mean, the mental side of this game is such a huge part of it.
There's no doubt. You know, you mentally, you know, if you're confident mentally, it's a great game, and you can make a great living. You know, I've had a bad spurt the last year and a half. I hadn't played very good, but I really just haven't had the confidence. You know, and I've had a couple decent rounds, you know, a few decent rounds this year. I just hadn't put four together. But the mental part of it, the physical part of it, it's all, if you don't have both of those, you know, it's a very, very tough game to play.
Well, the interesting thing is that you're a guy who's known for not spending a lot of time over a shot. The motto is grip it and rip it, right?
Pretty much, yeah.
when did you develop that approach?
Since when I picked up my first club, probably when I was 4 years old. When I started playing the game, I watched Nicklaus, and I fell in love with the game because of him, but I loved the way Fuzzy Zeller and Lee Trevino, they were quick, and Chichi, they were very quick when they played. They didn't think about it too much.
And that's Chichi Rodriguez, the old golfer with a funny hat, right?
Chichi, he was beautiful, and, you know, Trevino, everybody kind of knows Trevino, but, you know, the legends of the game. I mean, I love Nicklaus, how he won majors and how he won golf tournaments, but there's no way I could have played. He was very, very meticulous, very slow, you know. I couldn't play golf that way.
And what happens if you try and do it deliberately, take more time and analyze a shot?
It could go anywhere. It's just, you know, you just get used to what you feel and what you see in any sport. You know, you take a basketball player at free throw line, some take, you know, 20 seconds to shoot it, and some take one. It just depends on the feel and the rhythm that you have.
Well, you burst into prominence in 1991 when you were an unknown guy on the PGA Tour and won the PGA, one of the four big tournaments of the year. And it's a terrific story, and it begins with how you got in. I mean, you know, typically people on the tour for these big majors will spend a week or so playing at the course ahead of time. There are practice rounds the days leading up to the tournament. What did you do in the days leading up to that tournament in 1991?
Well, I was practicing at home Monday and Tuesday, and I was ninth alternate going into Wednesday morning, and I think I was still ninth alternate. And
meaning you were not even invited to play. You were the ninth.
No.
You were the ninth substitute if eight guys bailed.
Right, right. Actually, it was Tuesday, and then Wednesday I went down to like four, and then I got a call about 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock that evening. I was down to two, so I said, you know, I'll just drive up there. I got to do an event with Fuzzy close by there anyway. I'll go up and watch him play. And when I got into my hotel room, they said, you've got Nick Price's tee time at 12:20 or something like that on Thursday. So I never saw the golf course, didn't have a practice round. You know, I had a really, really good caddy. The thing was, Nick Price said, could you please use Squeaky? My caddy, he's up there, and, you know, Nick's, they had a baby that week. So I said, yeah, I'll use Squeaky. And he had walked the golf course, and, you know, Squeaky, our motto was, he just said, kill it, John. And that's what we did that week. Every shot, we just killed it.
The caddy, of course, is the golfer's guide to every little nook and cranny, getting all the distances right. What happened on the first day? How'd you do?
I played pretty good. I think I shot 3 under par. And then the second day, I think I shot 4 under or 5 under. And next thing you know, I was in the lead. And nobody really, it wasn't really that big of a deal to the fans. I mean, the fans were, it was a big deal to them. But the media was kind of like, who is this guy? You know, blah, blah, blah. He'll choke. You know, he. And then when I had the lead after Saturday and went to the Colt game, you know, there were 65,000 people that applauded me when I walked into the stadium, and I said, wow, this is really cool.
That was the Indianapolis Colts game where the owner invited you. But yeah, another interesting thing about that tournament, which a lot of people didn't know for a while, and that involved the rainstorm that hit the course on, I guess it was day one, right? What happened?
Yeah, it was Thursday afternoon. We actually had to go in for a little bit, for about a 45 to an hour and a half break, because the weather was so bad, and a man that got struck by lightning with 2 daughters and a wife. And, you know, when I won the tournament, I donated $30,000 to that family. And both daughters graduated from college. There's enough left over for one of their, another child, if they have a child, enough left over for them to go to school and college too. So
these girls lost their dad in this lightning strike that day. Did they even know that you had made this contribution when they were growing up?
Not at that age, no. And the mother invested the money so well, and she had some good people behind her investing it. And, you know, it's amazing where that $30,000 went to.
Let's talk a little bit about your life. You know, I a lot of people think of professional golfers as people who grew up on country clubs. What did your parents do?
My dad was in nuclear power plants. He was on the construction side of building, they call units. And he had started with Bechtel, and it turned into Stone and Webster, and we moved around an awful lot. I went to 4 different high schools growing up, so it wasn't a lot of fun, because you get to know somebody, you know, and then you got to leave. But it's kind of the way my career is, you know, you go from town to town to town to town, and you just meet all these beautiful fans and stuff. So it kind of helped me grow up a little quicker. But that's about it. Mom, she was just one of the greatest human beings in my life, and I lost her about 5 years ago, but she was always with us and home and stuff. So, you know, but you talk about people growing up on country clubs, and I was kind of grew up on, you know, a 9-hole golf course in Dardanelle, Arkansas. It was a country club, but let's put it this way. It's only $95 a month, and I own it now, and the members pay $95 a month. So you can almost say it's public. So I redid the clubhouse and redid the greens and bought all new equipment and did a new maintenance shed, so I've got it fixed up pretty good. Now I just need some more members.
Right, but you own this place that you played on when you were a kid. Yeah,
yeah. When I was 9 years old, I told all the members that I was going to own it one day, and I bought it a couple years ago, so it's kind of special to me.
Now, you write in this book that when you were a teenager, there were times when your dad would be away on construction jobs, I guess, including in Pennsylvania, and there came a time when your mom would travel with him, and that you say you and your brother Jamie kind of raised yourselves and got in the habit of having drinking parties at the house, which grew from a few dozen to sometimes a couple of hundred and got kind of wild. But I guess what I'm getting at is, I mean, clearly alcohol has been an issue in your life. I mean, you write in this that most people would be drunk for a month on what you had before dinner in a few years after this. I'm just wondering if maybe you developed a habit then that was not helpful to you.
No, probably not. I mean, I abused alcohol. I think a lot of us can say we have. But, you know, I think it in time, if you catch it quick enough, you know, social drinking is one thing, but just getting drunk because of a good round of golf or a bad round of golf like I did in college and my first few years as a pro, drinking was, you know, I took it to heart. You know, if I played really bad, I'd drink and just kind of just say the heck with it. And then if I played really good, I'd still drink. So, but usually when I get on the road now on tour, I don't even have any beers. I just relax and sit in the bus and drink Diet Cokes. And that's a big change. And I think it's an age, you know, once mm-hmm. you grow up a little bit more, those hangovers aren't as easy as, you know, to play golf on as they used to be. I used to be able to win golf tournaments on it. Now I don't want to get out of bed. So.
One of your trademarks is walking the golf course with a Marlboro Light in your mouth. And you tell a fascinating story in this book about how you started smoking. You were not a smoker in high school, right?
No, I didn't smoke first cigarette until I was 19. I was in college, and Coach Lloyd says, if you, you know, you don't lose 70 pounds, you're not playing for this team. He says, here, have a Marlboro Light. And I started smoking, and, you know, that's one thing I wish I never would have done. But I kept the weight off and, you know, gradually got into Marlboro mediums, and, you know, I'm smoking two packs a day. But it's the hardest thing to get off. I'll tell you, I haven't really ever thought about quitting, but I don't even know if I could.
But it was your college coach who suggested this as a weight loss tool?
Yeah, he says, do whatever you got to do. So I went into heavy Jack Daniels, drinking, you know, tons of that, and eating dry popcorn and smoking cigarettes. That's the only way I thought I could keep my weight off. You know, I lost 70 pounds in 3 months. He basically starved me. He weighed me every 3 days in the Broyles Complex. If I was a pound over what he thought I should be, I wasn't going to get to travel or play, whether I won qualifying or not. He was very, very – he was ruthless is what he was. He was just brutal.
You did stop drinking hard stuff, but then you write that you found two other addictions, chocolate and gambling, which you still addicted to chocolate?
Yeah, I mean, I don't eat as much as I used to, but and I still gamble a little bit, but not, you know, the middle 90s is when all that was taking place more than anything.
Yeah.
Because I was sober for 5 years, and I was the most miserable human being in the world, and I started drinking just before the British Open in 95, and not just, you know, boozing it up crazy. I just started drinking beer again, and I felt comfortable doing it. I felt like, wow, what a relief, you know. And everybody says, oh, you're in denial. So I'm not in denial. What am I in denial for? Yeah. I mean, I want to have a few beers. It's not a crime. It's not illegal. And next thing you know, I win the British Open because I was relaxed, and I had about 4 or 5 beers a night, you know, at the British just to, you know, I don't know. It made me feel good.
Well, you know, and I think for folks who don't know the game well, I mean, winning the British Open is not something you just dismiss in a phrase. It is one of the four really prestigious tournaments in a year. And this was at St. Andrews, which is, you know, the home of golf's oldest and most revered traditions. I mean, that was a really special time for you, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a great win. It's, you know, Nicklaus said it. He said, if you ever win at St. Andrews, the British Open there, your career's complete. So it's great to have that on the resume.
Pro golfer John Daly. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're speaking with pro golfer John Daly. His newest book is Golf My Own Damn Way. A lot of golfers, especially nowadays, have very rigorous training regimens and diets and really work hard at muscle development and staying in shape. You don't, right? Never have,
God
really.
God bless him. God bless him. Let him go puke and all that stuff and run and work out. This ain't football. You know? If I walk 7 miles a day, what more do I need to do?
You've got to repeat this exchange you had with Tiger Woods about that. You know what I'm talking about?
Oh, at the his tournament in Target. It was funny. I said, Tiger, why don't you come have a beer with us? And he says, nah, I got to go work out, man. If I had your talent, I'd be drinking a beer too.
That's a pretty good line. But, you know, it's interesting because golf is a game that you can play until you're old as an amateur, and now there's this tour for players over 50, the Champions Tour, and which, you know, gets television coverage and big crowds and a lot of money. And I wonder, you know, I remember Mickey Mantle once saying he wished he'd taken better care of himself and thought he could have played longer. Are you concerned that a lack of conditioning might limit your ability to play in future years?
Well, I think whether you work out or you're fit or whatever, injuries as you get older, you're going to get aches and pains. It doesn't matter if you're the strongest man in the world. And I don't think staying working out and stuff is going to stop anybody from doing that. I think the medicine that we have out there today that can stop arthritis and stop, you know, bones from aching and stuff is going to be a key probably in my life when I get older. But I don't think working out is going to be something that I need to really worry about. I think the best exercise is walking anyway. I think it keeps your heart at a nice pace rate. I don't like getting my heart all racing and stuff. I think it causes a lot of problems, but I'm not a doctor. If that's my excuse for not working out, I'm sticking to it. Anyway, I mean, I don't believe in having to work out to play the game of golf. I just don't. If people enjoy working out, God bless them. If people enjoy running, God bless them. I enjoy smoking a cigarette, drinking a Diet Coke when I get up in the morning, and going to the first tee. And, you know, I believe nicotine and caffeine equal protein. That's my line.
Well, it's worked for you so far. Although you've had some nagging injuries over the past year, right? Do you expect you're going to kind of get them in shape and get back to winning on the tour again?
Yeah, this time off, I hopefully will help my shoulder. The ribs been pretty good. Doc only had to pop it in two times, but my shoulders had been popped in five times. And yeah, it was a rough incident. We were at Honda on the 12th hole, which I played the back nine. It was my first nine. So usually on Thursday and Fridays, if the people don't know, we play early late or late early, and we go on the front nine or back nine, whichever day, the first day or second day. But I was on the 12th tee box, my third hole that morning, and a lady with a camera just came out of her house. There was no security walls inside this complex or this golf course. People were just walking out of their houses, taking pictures, which is totally against all our bylaws and stuff at the tour. The tour really messed up on this one. And she had a flash camera, and I backed away from my shot twice. They didn't confiscate the camera, which they're supposed to do. And she got me when I was right ready to come down. She flashed it again. I closed my eyes, and I stopped, and my shoulder, you could hear it crack. And my rib went dead left into my back. And within 30 minutes when I got into the physiotherapy trailer, the rib had swelled up to almost, there's like a golf ball size that they had to massage out, and the shoulder was separated. They couldn't get it back in. They couldn't get the rib back in. So I got to put a brace on, drive my bus from Honda all the way to Fayetteville, Arkansas, because I only trust Doc Whitelaw. And I got there, and sure enough, he popped it back in, and he got the rib back in. That was what was really painful.
Huh. Did you ever meet the lady?
No. There was a police report and everything, but the thing is, it really hurt me this year because I had to withdraw from nine or ten tournaments because of the shoulder and three because of the ribs. So, you know, that's tough.
Yeah.
It hurts the sponsors. I'm probably going to lose pretty much all my sponsors. I hope not, but I've played really bad. And I can't blame them, but it's just been one of those years where that injury really hurt my career.
And so what happens there is that you've cranked your body around, you're at the top of the backswing, and then trying to stop with all that momentum is what injured
you.
Yeah.
I've never how long have I been a tour? 18 years. I've never, ever had to stop on my downswing. It's almost humanly impossible, but I just flinched. The flash, it wasn't like it was a bright, sunny day. There's some kind of cloud covering, and, you know, a flash like that, you can't help but flinch.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and people who know your swing, it comes down with the force of a locomotive. I mean,
135 miles an hour trying to stop that's you know,
right.
That wasn't easy to do.
You know, you sound like somebody who tries not to be too hard on yourself. I mean, you can sort of accept what life gives you. And, you know, one of the toughest things in playing a round of golf is accepting a bad shot and forgetting about it and moving on. I mean, do you think you're kind of built in a way to play this game?
Well, I think more of my mentality. And, you know, growing up, I used to just get really, really mad. And now I just accept that, hey, I got to move on. And I've learned to deal with bad shots. I've learned to deal with very strong curves and horseshoe bends in my life. But, you know, I think I'm a lot more mature than I used to be. Of course, we all grow up, and things don't bother us as much. You know, it's like just a simple thing, like if the bed isn't made. I used to just have to make the bed up every morning. I'm a neat freak. And every morning, even if it's a hotel or my bus or my home, I got to make the bed up. And now I just say, well, you know, maybe I'll get to it later. And that's kind of the way I live right now. I'm not in no hurry to really get a lot of stuff done. I'm just kind of slowing down. And I wish when I was 25 I could have been like this. Huh. You know, I think maybe if I wouldn't have got so uptight and got so emotionally mad at myself for hitting a bad shot. You know, Tiger does get mad, but he rebounds quickly. I didn't, it would be one or two holes back when I was younger that I would screw up even more because I wasn't forgetting about that hole before. And now I just kind of go on with life like, hey, whatever, throw something at me, I'll get through it. I'm used to it.
When did you become a neat freak? That's interesting.
Ever since I was eight years old, my mom never had to vacuum my room, make up my bed, or fold any clothes. I wasn't very good with the laundry. She taught me how to iron. She taught me the laundry and stuff. It took me a while to get the washer and the dryer. I used to just stuff everything in there and then throw it in the dryer, thinking it wouldn't do anything. But, you know, my red shirt became pink. My brown shorts became red. I mean, you know, but I learned quickly. But, no, I just felt like if I have everything in place, organized, I'll know where everything is. And like my bus, I like for the candles to be lit and smell good. I like for it to be clean. I don't, you know, it's just the way I've always been ever since a kid. And my wife enjoys that. she never really has to make up the bed. And, you know, the only thing I really don't, she gets mad at me because I like to clean the dishes. I don't believe in dishwashers. I think I can clean the dishes better than the dishwasher can.
Well, John Daly, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Well, thank you. Appreciate it.
Pro golfer John Daly. His memoir is My Life in and Out of the Rough. His new book is Golf My Own Damn Way. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble and the Barnes & Noble Review, the new online literary magazine with reviews, interviews, and recommendations. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at macfound.org. And from Miramax Films, presenting the new Coen Brothers motion picture, No Country for Old Men, in select theaters November 9th, everywhere November 21st. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, rejected by the New Yorker magazine. We talk with cartoonist Matthew Diffie, who's edited a new collection of cartoons that didn't make it into the New Yorker. Some were too lowbrow, some too weird, some hard to get. Also, Ed Ward tells us about the career of Jerry Williams Jr., also known as Swamp Dog, who co-wrote the song She's All I Got, which was a hit by Freddie North and Johnny Paycheck. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. If you subscribe to The New Yorker, or just pick it up while waiting at the dentist's office, you probably start by flipping through and looking at the cartoons. Our guest Matthew Diffie's cartoons appear regularly in The New Yorker, but even he, every week, has to deal with most of his submissions being rejected by the editors, a process that Diffie says may or may not involve the use of darts. But Matthew Diffie deals well with this rejection. He's just come out with his second volume of The Rejection Collection, drawn from the hundreds of cartoons rejected by The New Yorker each year. The appendix in the back of the book lists 10 possible reasons why cartoons get rejected. It includes too lowbrow, too weird, too dumb, too dirty, and too bad. Diffie has had more than 100 cartoons published in the magazine during the 8 years he's been a contributor. Well, Matthew Diffie, welcome to Fresh Air. This book has some very funny rejected cartoons in it, and I thought we'd begin by me sharing one of my favorites, which is one that you did that did not make it into the magazine, and it's a picture of an elephant in a zoo, and there's a sign facing the visitors, which reads, "Please do not feed the animals chili."
Yes, well, the fact that that's your favorite tells me a lot about you, and this should be a fun interview.
Yeah, what does it tell you?
Well, I don't know. You go for the sophomoric lowbrow stuff.
That's exactly it. Right. A cruder sensibility than many.
The funny thing to me about these cartoons in this book is that we actually submitted them to the New Yorker. Like a joke like that, which is, you know, essentially a farting elephant gag. At some point, some inner critic didn't talk me out of submitting it to the New Yorker.
I'm wondering how, you know, writing for this medium, a single panel cartoon, is different from other forms of humor.
Well, to me, it's really hard. I've written stand-up material, and I've written some, you know, longer form stuff. To me, it's so precise and so boiled down, and combining the element of the visual with the verbal, it's a really tough thing. And you can't count on any sort of performance ability. Like when you're writing a stand-up joke, you can kind of count on the comedian doing a funny voice or his timing or like the rhythm of it following a series of other jokes. But a cartoon stands alone, or it has to do everything in a really short amount of time.
Tell us a little bit about just the basics. I mean, how many cartoonists are working every week? How many they submit? What the vetting process is?
Yeah, there's probably, I guess, between maybe 20 and 50 cartoonists who appear in the magazine on somewhat a regular basis. Some people, of course, more often than others. And we all do about 10 ideas a week and bring them in or mail them in, fax them in to Bob Mankoff, who's the cartoon editor. We do that on Tuesday. Bob then goes through them and picks his favorites and takes them to David Remnick, the editor of the magazine. And on Thursday, we will get a phone call saying we sold one, or we will get nothing if we didn't sell one. And on a good week, that's what you do. You sell one out of your 10 batch. So, you know, a 90% rejection rate is actually really, really good.
Wow. This collection of cartoons that didn't make it into the New Yorker is mostly not your work. You have you have 38 cartoonists here, and you have some examples of each of their work that didn't make it into the magazine, but you also have an interesting way of kind of having them present a self-biography. Would you describe what you did?
Well, the idea is that people know the New Yorker cartoons, but they don't know the New Yorker cartoonists. And I think that's a shame because these people are wonderful, creative, you know, interesting people. So I put together this questionnaire that they all have to fill out. And, you know, it's coming from me, so it's already a little bit of a weird, twisted sort of questionnaire. And they all do the same questions in really different, unique ways. I think it's probably my favorite part of the book. But I'm asking stupid questions like, have you been mooned or mooned more often in your life? And it's interesting to see what Roz Chast or somebody, you know, that you know as a New Yorker cartoonist has to say about that. Or on a scale of 1 to 10, how Jewish are you?
I actually remember Roz Chast's answer, I think, to whether you've been mooned or mooned more. Do you remember it?
I don't remember it, actually.
I think she said, I'm mooning you right now.
Oh, yeah. I've been always impressed. If you give these setups to the cartoonists, they just knock it out of the park, you know, and it's really becomes a nice theme through the book to compare people's, the way that people think. You know, sometimes they do the same thing, and then sometimes they do things that only they could do, but it's a very entertaining part. And also, I had them take photographs of themselves. This year, they had to take a photograph of their face and of their hands and of their feet and of their refrigerator and of their drawing space. I think that's it. So everyone did that on their own in their own different way. It's certainly a glimpse into how their mind works.
Right. I have to correct what I said earlier. When I thumbed through the book, it was not Roz Chast who said, "I'm mooning you right now," but one of the cartoonists did indeed say that.
It would be funnier if it was Roz Chast, I think.
Well, she missed that chance.
Yeah.
Pick a cartoon that you like, and if you can, tell us how you came up with it.
Well, I can tell you about one that people apparently like a lot of mine. It gets reprinted a lot. It's a cartoon. I'll have to describe it, which to me is already funny, doing cartoons on the radio. It's Che Guevara, or however you say his name. I don't even know how, but Che wearing a T-shirt. And, you know, people probably know the picture, the T-shirt with Che's face on it. So this is him wearing a T-shirt, and instead of, well, the face on his shirt is Bart Simpson. So it's a purely visual gag, and I know how I came up with that because I moved to Williamsburg in Brooklyn, which is where all the hip kids live, and I don't quite fit in. But I started to see this T-shirt on the subway, you know, ad nauseum, perhaps, and then I figured out, okay, that is something going on in the culture, and it's visual, and I can reference it. And so then it wasn't long before I got the idea, okay, I'll put him in a T-shirt. And once I had that, then it was just a matter of, you know, going through the potential revolutionary figures that he would have on his shirt, and I settled on Bart.
Right. And that one made it into the book.
That one made it into The New Yorker, actually.
Right, right.
And but usually I just start with a phrase, you know, something that, like, for instance, the one you mentioned with the chili, you know, please don't feed the animals. That's usually what the phrase is, but you can often add a word on to the end of something like that. And then when you combine it with an elephant and chili, to me, it makes a complete idea.
Right.
I'll often do that. I'll take a phrase and tweak one word or change it or add a word. I had a cartoon with a waiter bringing out plates to a table. And like in New York, and he's saying, careful, these plates are extremely dirty, which is just changing the one word that you expect with a surprising word, which also has another additional idea of meaning, because that is really more frightening than a hot plate is a dirty
right,
plate.
Right, right, right. So there's a little trick of the trade. Add the word.
Yeah.
And with the
change it, you know.
Right. And with the elephant cartoon, I mean, it could have been, please don't feed the animals chili. You could have put a raccoon. But this enormous elephant, he's somehow looking as if I've got a little indigestion.
Well, that's good. If I actually drew an elephant that can put across the idea of I don't feel so good, that would be great. But, yeah, it's a combination. And I had a tendency when I started out in Mankoff, the cartoon editor, who I don't want to paint as a bad editor. He's not, you know, there's just too many cartoons for him to put in each issue of the magazine. But he told me early on, he said, you know, don't write stand-up jokes. And I had a tendency to do that. I would write a joke that's perfectly funny by itself, and then I would simply draw a person saying it to another person. And that, you know, you can get away with that sometimes, but it's not a pure cartoon, because a cartoon needs one part of it needs to be dependent on the visual, either the setup or the punchline. Either one can be visual, but it needs that to be a pure cartoon in my mind.
Pick a few cartoons from the book and ones that can be described on the radio and tell us why they may have been rejected. I assume you don't get a reason. It just doesn't make the cut, right?
Yeah, you don't get a reason, but some of them, certainly in this second volume, you can kind of figure out why. You know, there's so many. Every cartoon in here is a favorite of mine because I picked it, but I'll try to think of a few of them. There's the David Cypress had one with a bar graph showing the sales of Viagra over the years. And, of course, the bar graph early on is somewhat droopy, and then it becomes more, what should we say, straight up and down.
Right.
As
erect.
It goes on,
right,
which
right.
is erect. Okay. It's a great joke to me, a visual gag.
But it's what? It's too what? Explicitly sexual or what?
Not only that, but it's also Viagra, which is a little bit of a lowbrow kind of topic. You can do cartoons about, you know, sex and sexuality, but, you know, Viagra perhaps is overdone and a little too easy. I think Mueller, P.S. Mueller, has some great stuff. There's the Titanic action figures, which is just a bunch of floating dead bodies, which is terrible, but really funny to me, and there's several in here that are funny. But I guess that was, you know, maybe that was a timely thing. You know, it would have been perfect to have it when the movie was out, and then it you know, missed its window of opportunity, so we brought it back.
There's the one from Mike Tui, if I'm saying his name correctly, where he's got a doctor has a patient on the table, and he's got his backside in the air, and the doctor is saying, well, we couldn't find anything with a sigmoidoscope. Looks like we'll have to send in Junior here. And there's a little guy there in a wetsuit and goggles getting ready to... it's the picture.
Well, that's definitely, you know, that's a lowbrow kind of a... Me and Mike had discussions long into the night. Well, not really, but we did have discussions about the wording of that, whether it should be, we'll have to send in Junior, or we'll have to send up Junior.
Uh-huh.
Very, very complicated issue and very important in our line of work. And then also sigmoidoscope. I didn't know that was a real thing.
Yeah.
I thought you'd made that up.
Right,
but apparently
right,
that's
right.
The accurate thing.
And again, this may be just too lowbrow, but Michael Shaw's piece of two Tyrannus Rex are talking. And, of course, they have those shrunken little forepaws up top, and one of them is saying, I'd give up being the most fearsome creature on Earth if I could just reach my weenie.
Yeah. To me, that's nearly poetry.
Right.
Reach my weenie. I mean, it's a funny joke. And it does reference something that people have sort of beat around a little bit before, the fact that they have small upper arms, but this is a hilarious way to look at it, I think.
But maybe
and
not.
The contrast between this fearsome beast and his simple little hopes.
Cartoonist Matthew Diffie, his book of cartoons that didn't make it into The New Yorker is called Rejection Collection Volume 2. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Matthew Diffie. He is a cartoonist for The New Yorker who has edited a new collection of cartoons from more than three dozen artists that didn't make it into the book. It's called The Rejection Collection Volume 2, The Cream of the Crap. How much do the cartoonists talk to each other, you 38 or 40 people that are competing with each other every week?
Quite a lot, actually. The ones that live in the city, you know, we drop off our ideas Tuesday morning and then we all shuffle off to have lunch together and, you know, complain and gripe. And we're kind of a tight bunch. It's not competitive, you know, any more than it has to be, but it's not up to us. So, you know, we're a pretty friendly bunch.
Yeah, fair enough. You just submit your stuff and then you get an answer.
Yeah.
You know, one of the fun things that readers like about The New Yorker is that feature on the back page now where the reader is invited to submit a caption for a picture, you know, you write your own caption. There's a, you know, a kind of an outrageous or funny situation depicted, and you're invited to submit a caption. Yeah. I assume the pros are barred from entering that competition, right?
Right. We're not allowed to submit captions. It's hard. I don't know if I could do it that way.
I was just going to say, do you ever do it for fun or no?
No. I mean, some of the other guys work that way. I think they draw themselves into a corner and try to come up with a caption, but I've tried to work that way, but I just end up with a drawing and I can't think of anything.
Yeah.
But that's an example of how we get accepted and rejected at the same time, because they'll buy a cartoon from you and say, yeah, we're going to buy this cartoon for the caption contest, which means they're going to take your drawing but lose your caption in the hopes that the readers will come up with something better.
Oh, that's so, where those come from.
At least that's how it's happened for me. I've done it twice, and that's how it's happened for me. Maybe some others are just a picture to start with. But usually I think it's a cartoon that we submit and Bob sees something in the visual that would lead to other interpretations.
Yeah, well, what's one that you submitted that had the text ripped
one,
away?
I did one with a little girl playing a violin and her teacher is sitting there kind of frightened and the room is in a shambles. Obviously, something has just happened that completely destroyed the room, and the teacher is very frightened. And my original caption was, okay, once more with a little less feeling.
Okay.
And so I turned that in, and they said, we're going to take it for the caption contest. So they took my caption off of it and then had, you know, I think like 9,000 people enter this thing.
Really?
And they ended up picking as a finalist my exact caption from somebody.
No kidding.
And it was the winner. Which I guess is good.
Oh, how ironic.
Yeah, it's amazing. And it's very interesting when you see they break down the entries, and so many people have the same idea. It's fascinating. And many people will have your idea or some really close variety of it.
When a cartoon gets selected for the caption contest, do they pay you less?
No, it's the same amount, thankfully. Okay. Otherwise, I think the cartoonist would revolt.
Right.
Some of the cartoonists are very against this, by the way. They claim that, you know, you wouldn't put a, you know, Rick Hertzberg article in there and leave off the last paragraph and have people write in their version of the last paragraph. I think it's a good thing because I think it's getting people thinking about, you know, what we do. This is what I hoped it would do. I hoped it would make people think, wow, this is really hard what they do. This is tough. But on the end, it's the opposite. Everywhere I go, everyone that's ever done it is convinced that theirs should have won.
Are there any other cartoons in the book you want to talk about and ones that didn't make it in?
Gosh, once I start.
Once you start.
I mean, Mick Stevens has a great one with Tonto and the Lone Ranger in bed
describe
together.
Yeah,
it's Tonto and Lone Ranger in bed together, obviously after having some sort of intimate moment. And the Lone Ranger is saying, oh, so that's what kemosabe means. Which is, you know, probably people have been all just around that idea and didn't quite nail it, but, you know, he certainly nailed it.
Right.
And that's what I like to see. As a cartoonist, you know, I've probably thought around a lot of these topics before and didn't quite get the idea. And so to see somebody else just get it, you're like, oh, I should have done that. That's great. So that's what, you know, the book is for me. Cartoons that I wish I had done.
Yeah. That convention of two people in a bed with the covers halfway up, obviously, after an intimate moment, is widely used. And there's this wonderful one by C. Cover Derbyshire with a guy with the mice. Do you want to describe that one?
Yeah. So it's a scientist in bed with, I don't know, 20 white laboratory mice, which is already pretty funny. And then another scientist, I guess, has barged into the room or opened the door and caught them in this scene. And I might not get the caption exactly right, but it's something to the effect of, do you have it there?
Yeah, I have it. I mean, he said, there are all these mice lined up with the covers halfway up their little bodies.
Yeah.
And he says, yes, it's exactly what it looks like. And no, I don't know where this leaves us and our research.
Yeah. There's another one here I just happened to flip to by Zachary Cannon. It's a homeless guy or a hobo in bed with a lady. And the homeless guy is saying, I really would have just settled for some spare change,
right?
Which is funny to me. There's another one on the opposite page by Zach that's pretty funny. It's a toilet with a little friendly little face and eyes on it. So it's a talking toilet character saying, today is going to be different. I can feel it. There's something very sad and funny about this optimistic potty to me.
Well, Matthew Diffie, thanks so much for spending some time with us.
Thank you. It's very fun.
Cartoonist Matthew Diffie. He's edited a book of cartoons that didn't make it into The New Yorker called Rejection Collection, Volume 2. Coming up, Ed Ward on the career of Jerry Williams Jr., also known as Swamp Dog. This is Fresh Air. Jerry Williams Jr. has been calling himself Swamp Dog for close to 40 years, but his career goes back even longer than that. He's one of America's most eccentric musicians, and today rock historian Ed Ward tries to get a handle on the many faces of a songwriter, producer, and performer who's made a career out of popping up where you least expect him.
Jerry Williams made his first record in 1954 when he was 11 years old. His mother was on drums, his stepfather played the guitar, his step-uncle was on bass.
Hey, baby, I like to tell you how I feel. Oh, baby, I like to tell you how I feel.
I'll be driven by my clothes, and every day give me a free meal.
Little Jerry, of course, played the piano, the instrument he's played since he could climb up onto the stool. He was surrounded by music in his house, and in Portsmouth, Virginia, his hometown, opportunities to play were everywhere. At his church hall, where he and his band played every Friday night, and on a local television station, where they went after the dance for a 45-minute show. By the time he was 14, Little Jerry was making $125 a week, big money in 1956. 3 years later, out of high school, he was playing dives in Newark, pretending to be Little Willie John, Don Covey, or Larry Williams, depending on who had the biggest hit at the time. Jerry himself was trying for a hit, too, and sometime around 1959, he actually had a regional Midwestern number one record called I'll Always Remember Chapel on the Hill.
I'm writing this letter.
The record label's owner died in an automobile accident shortly thereafter, and Jerry signed with someone who decided he was the Black Jerry Lee Lewis.
Hello, I'm glad to meet you. Come over here and let me greet you. You're nice and third, a swinging bird. You're a big, thrilling, lot of willing soul chilling. Baby! How'd you do? Did you blow in the town? I know that you're a highway bound. I want you to know, I'm glad.
In 1960, so I'm living in Philadelphia and New York, trying to support his wife and four daughters on gigs here and there and the occasional record. Finally, disgusted, he moved back to Portsmouth and wound up in the Army. A week later, he got a hardship discharge and continued his peripatetic career. Early in 1970, though, he had an inspiration. Tired of being Little Jerry, he went into the studio with some top Southern musicians and some odd songs and reinvented himself. Little Jerry Williams had become Swamp Dog. Somehow, the album, Total Destruction to Your Mind, reached a writer for a new magazine, Rolling Stone, who praised its funkiness and its weirdness, and it started getting played on FM stations. The cover, which showed him sitting in a junkyard in his underwear with a tin pot on his head, didn't hurt either. His next album was Rat On, which showed him sitting astride a giant white rat. If he'd bothered to tour, Swamp Dog might have become a star, but Jerry Williams had other ideas. Collaborating with his friend Gary U.S. Bonds, he'd written a song for the Nashville soul singer Freddie North.
Friend, don't take her, she's all I've got.
Country producer Billy Sherrill was in the studio as Williams produced the record and commented that it was a hit. He asked if once North's version had had its run on the soul charts, where it was a top 10 record in the summer of 1971, he could have it for a country star whose career he was hoping to revive. Sure, said Williams, and so it happened.
Well, I said, friend, don't take her, she's all I've got. Please don't take her love away from me.
As Cheryl predicted, She's All I Got made Johnny Paycheck a star again. It shot to the top of the country charts, and in 1972 was named Song of the Year at the Country Music Awards. Swamp Dog still fondly remembers the gasp that came out of the crowd when he went on stage to accept. Swamp Dog continued to release albums filled with angry protest songs and country soul masterpieces, while Jerry Williams produced hits by Doris Duke, Irma Thomas, ZZ Hill, and others. And in 2007, Swamp Dog, fed up with the state of the world, came out with another record of protest music, Resurrection. I hear he's also written a cookbook called You Kill It, I'll Cook It. Just keeping up with him can cause total destruction to your mind.
Ed Ward lives in Berlin. Finally today, she wouldn't mention it, but we will. Last night, Terry Gross was honored at the National Book Awards ceremony with the Literarian Award, presented by the National Book Foundation for Outstanding Service to the Literary Community. The award panel noted the intelligence and dedication with which she continues to create public conversation about the best books in America, to which we add, way to go, Terry. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for NPR comes from Bantam Books, publisher of The God Machine, From Boomerangs to Blackhawks, The Story of the Helicopter, by James R. Childs. From the dairy farm families who own Cabot Creamery, five generations of farming and making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont at cabotcheese.coop. And from CNN, presenting tonight's Democratic presidential debate live from Las Vegas with moderator Wolf Blitzer, tonight at 9 Eastern on CNN. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Nixon and Kissinger, their collaborations and rivalries, backstabbing intrigues and foul language. We talk with presidential historian Robert Dalek. His book about their partnership is now out in paperback. Dalek describes the two as co-presidents. Join us for the next Fresh Air.